Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hi, everyone. It is Monday, July 14th, 2025, and we have a big show for you today. So thank you for being here. As I look to prepare Scoop for you, I think of two different things, and really our shows can sort of go two different directions. One, I like to give you a serving of news about what's actually happening that week and looking ahead a few days. Oftentimes in the news cycle, we're just looking ahead a few hours, and it's sort of helpful to know, oh, by the way, you know, the House is holding a hearing on weather forecasting this week. And oh, there is something else that the Senate's working on. And oh, this happened in history. So sort of giving you a calendar of events or setting the table for you for the week ahead is one of the focuses that we can sort of pick and choose when I'm looking to produce Scoop for you. So we have that calendar, by the way, always in our newsletter that goes out to our insiders. It's a cheat sheet that arrives in your inbox on Mondays that gives that to you regardless. So if I don't get to it during the broadcast, it's always tucked inside your newsletter. So again, you can kind of have an idea of what's going on in the week ahead. And then know if you get a news item related to that story, you kind of already had context for it. So that's something that we try to do on Scoop. The other strategy I take for this show is thinking about, what are you going to see this week? You know, what is coming across your desk? Sort of like a weather forecaster, I use that term, you know, what's on your radar? You know, what is potentially out there for you that you're going to stumble upon that we can add a little clarity about? And what we're going to do today is more leaning towards that for this scoop, which is a lot of different stories, but I think you're going to see something about a lot of these stories at some point this week. So I want to make sure that you're prepped and ready. What I think of is that we are your personal producers, getting you ready for the week ahead. And I don't want to bother you every single day. I want to give you a good serving as you start off the week so then you can kind of move on with your life. You feel prepped and ready and equipped to face the news that we know and also face the news that could come up unexpected. Obviously, one of the big news stories that was very unexpected this month were these historic floods in Texas. And that is one of our big news items as we start off the week. The news item or the headline that we continue to see in Texas and really around the country is more flooding. And we actually knew about this because Ben Knoll, who is a meteorologist and writer for the Washington Post, he's a global weather writer for the Post, joined us late on Friday night. And he lives in New Zealand, so we had to kind of figure out the timing for all of this. But one of the reasons I reached out to him is that he was forecasting in the middle of last week more flooding to come, not only in the Texas Hill Country and beyond, in the days and weeks ahead, the weeks ahead. So not just even in just the month of July. I want to play a little sound from that interview, even if you heard it already. This is an exchange between us when I'm really trying to get to the heart of why is this happening? Anything unique that you're seeing, particularly to this time period, that isn't part of a gradual trend, but stands out to you as like, wait a minute, this is something different that we haven't necessarily seen before?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen over the last couple of years on a global scale is in 2024, it was a record breaker for the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And I think to, you know, use an analogy, water vapor is like fuel in your gas tank. And the more fuel that you have, the farther you can go. So the more fuel there is in the atmosphere, the more rain that can fall out of the sky. It's not a one-to-one relationship. It doesn't, you know, mean that just because there's a record that you're going to get a record amount of rainfall. But it's kind of like, you know, loading the dice in a casino. If you put some weight on the dice and whatever, you roll it and it rolls, you know, a certain number more frequently than not. I think what this is doing, this trend is doing, is kind of tipping the odds toward more intense rainfall over time. It doesn't mean that, you know, tomorrow, the next day, you're going to have another, you know, catastrophic flood in your backyard. But I think as time goes on, this is something that we're all going to become more aware of, this kind of increasing potential for rainfall extremes across the country and the world, for that matter.
So interesting from Ben. So we have more water vapor, and that is giving, again, just that extra fuel, the extra ingredient that makes these scenarios a little more likely. I asked him a question that I realized after I asked it could veer into the political, because when we talk about climate change, isn't it funny? Every single topic has a political angle, or someone could take it in a political way. I wasn't asking it in that way. I was asking, you know, what are some of the new elements that we're seeing now? But then how do we square that with a past where we're seeing massive flooding that took place in the same area? And what Ben told me is that, yes, we have seen precedent, past precedent for some of the flooding that we're seeing. It doesn't mean that every ingredient, though, is the same. And so this extra water vapor is part of the reason that we're seeing one of the ingredients that could lead to more of this type of weather, not only in Texas, but also beyond. One of the other questions I asked of Ben, and this is going to be a topic of conversation really moving into the future, we are seeing a hearing on Capitol Hill this week about technology and innovation and weather forecasting, is, you know, how good is our weather forecasting now? And he was very positive on this side and said, listen, our weather forecasting and our ability to understand what's happening is very high. And he even said he didn't see anything that stood out to him that was wrong about the forecast in the historic floods in Texas. One of the things he said, and this is kind of a tip we can tuck into our back pocket, he said it's often that you get a weather forecast that's going to show extreme weather. And then as you get closer to the day or the event, it sort of gets toned down. He's like, that's not what we saw here. Instead, we saw it being like the volume being turned up. So he's like, it's sort of likely that you could get, hey, you know, we're seeing a ramp up of weather and then it sort of peters out, but that's not what we saw here. It kept going. And here's something else that he shared with me. And this is an anecdote I don't think I'll forget. I wanted to share it with you as well. Is he said, yes, I can tell you where the storm is, but there are parts of the storm that I can't entirely explain. And take a listen to what he says here.
It's kind of another subset of forecasting challenges with forecasting thunderstorms, because to give a quick analogy, when it comes to forecasting thunderstorms, you're basically trying to understand what popcorn kernel is going to pop first in the microwave. And that's anyone's guess. It's you know, it's like guesswork. But we do know that, you know, when the ingredients come together that are ripe for thunderstorms, that they can be really intense. And that's what forecasters are really good at. Not exactly the placement of the worst thunderstorm, but the general area where the ingredients for thunderstorms are most ripe. So yeah, I would say that those conditions kind of ramped up as we got closer. And that is definitely, I think, a red flag when it comes to forecasting.
Isn't that interesting? Just thinking about, I was thinking about popping popcorn on a stovetop where you actually are actually watching the kernels. And it is a curious thing when you wonder which one is going to go first. And as soon as one goes, then you get a plethora of popping that starts happening. So understanding that weather forecasters can sort of see the glob, but don't know exactly where the thunder and lightning is going to strike first. And that could affect the weather and what sort of weather that you see on the ground. A great question from Tara here. Jenna, did he explain why there is more water vapor in the air over time? Tara, he did. And let me go ahead and show this to you. If you're watching, I'm going to explain it to those of you who are going to be joining us on a podcast. I'm going to take you to Ben's X feed. It's my understanding, he has a great X feed. So I highly suggest that you follow him, and you can look up, again, I'll link to this in the show notes, because you can see it even if, I think you can still see it even if you don't have a subscription on X. One of the reasons why he says that we're seeing this increased water vapor is because of the temperature of the water in the Gulf, as well as around the coast of Florida into the Carolinas. So he says the hotter water there is then leading to more water vapor. And it's, you know, as he was explaining, goes up super, super high. It's not like something that you're seeing sort of like fog. It's just an element that's out there. What he's saying this week is that there is a chance for flooding along the coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. And that's where we're continuing to watch about a tropical storm sort of gathering together. We watch for tropical storms because we're watching for hurricanes. And so in one of his posts here, he's talking about sea surface temperature and how that's an element that we're also watching as we're watching this tropical storm. But this is all connected. It's all connected to the heavy rainfall that we're seeing. In the way that he's explaining, yes, these are different weather patterns. You know, what's happening over Texas isn't necessarily the same weather pattern that Florida is experiencing, but they're the similar elements that are a part of it. And so I'm showing a map here that is looking at rainfall for Monday and Tuesday, and you can see flash flooding is likely in Florida, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Northeast. We're going as far north as New York City. Even places around DC, we're expecting a lot of rain, but 14 states could see what he's describing as a volatile day for downpours. So this is a way that we're looking at the story in Texas, again, as historic and deadly as this flood was and continues to be, and expanding it out to understand this isn't just a story about Texas. We saw these really deadly floods as well in New Mexico. We saw flooding in North Carolina last week, and now we're looking ahead. And so part of the reason I wanted to mention this to you is because it is easy to sort of shrug off weather warnings. And you may think to yourself, well, Jenna, you know, I don't live near a river. I'm not along the coast. The idea that I'm going to see some sort of flooding is not very high. And that may be the case. But we all might get into a situation where we see water on the road, or we do get a warning and think, okay, do I really want to leave now, or I'm going to give it a couple hours? And so I want to equip you with that and as something just to think about as you're going into the back half of this year. A quick personal story here. I was hoping actually to be broadcasting from Kerrville today. Our plan was to go out to Kerrville on Sunday to help understand the organization of a volunteer group we were going to go with. And on Sunday morning, that was called off because the whole area was shut down because of flash flood warnings, because the rain continues here in Texas. And it's creating definitely an obstacle for these recovery efforts and the debris efforts the cleanup efforts that are taking place. So we weren't able to go yesterday. My husband got up this morning and there was a question about whether or not the group was going to go today or not and how that was going to look and if it was going to be raining. And yes, it's still raining there. He went out with this group, a much smaller group than what was planned, to try to see, well, okay, if certain areas are shut down, what are areas that are safe, private property that needs help? I mean, the amount of debris is so extremely overwhelming and is going to take weeks. So we're looking for ways to help. I was looking for ways to help and also go and get some eyes on this for you. And it's been something that I've tried to do for the last week. And every single time we think that we're ready to get out there, it's not far, as I mentioned to you. It's 90 minutes. It's close. There's a flash flood warning. There's road shut down. Yesterday, it was significant that the judge in the area that came under fire, so this is the judge for Kerr County, issued an alert that basically shut things down. So they're being a little bit more conservative, obviously, than they were in the past. No, and with their argument, considering their argument that they weren't expecting the water that they saw and the level of water that they saw, in trying to protect people. And because there's a rush of people to the area and a lot of people that aren't familiar with the area, they're trying to do the best that they can to be helpful. now you have a new complication of you have people in the area aren't familiar with the area, not familiar with the roads. Some of the roads are still shut down. Yes, we have some more flooding. So this is an evolving story here in Texas. It's not done yet, even though that the main part of the flood, that very intense event, you know, happened more than a week ago. So it's ongoing. And the story about this particular weather pattern in America is also ongoing. On that, because you're going to hear more about flooding, likely, you're going to hear about more flash flooding, unfortunately. There has been a term that's come up in the press, and I'm sure amongst casual conversation or maybe on social media in front of you, and it's cloud seeding. Have you heard this term, cloud seeding? It's not something that I've tackled before on the news, and it's something that's coming up here. So what is cloud seeding? What do we need to know about it? I just want to give you a real quick, couple quick bullet points on it. We could do hours and hours of a broadcast. And in fact, if you're interested in it, I'm happy to do a little bit more research, get an interview on it, dig in a little deeper here. The important thing to know about cloud seeding, this is weather modification. So cloud seeding is as it sounds. We're going to put an ingredient essentially in a cloud that is ripe for not necessarily rainfall, but for snowflakes. And we're going to get it to lead to precipitation. So we are actually going to add an ingredient to a ripe cloud that's then going to lead to precipitation in some way. The important thing to know about this is that it's not just woo-woo, that it is real, that this technology dates back to the 1940s. Part of the U.S. government was doing research on this particular technology in the 1940s. And it's also true that the technology was used in Vietnam. It's been well documented to try to use weather and heavy rains as part of a strategy to stop the flow of goods and supplies to our enemy in Vietnam. So it's been used, it is established. It doesn't mean that it's not without question, but just even knowing in this day and age that something is a real concept, I think is important. And so this is a technology that's been around, well, let's see, going on about 80 years now. So it's not a new technology, but it is being used now with some perhaps more frequency and being used in a way by states to try to lead to more water, because people are in need of water. Farmers are in need of water. Communities are in need of water. And so states can hire companies, or even groups can hire companies like Rainmaker, which is a cloud seeding company, and you're going to hear from the CEO in just a second, to lead to more precipitation. This is something that's been actively happening in Texas for several years. So the reason why I'm also mentioning this is that this cloud seeding company, Rainmaker, was seeding clouds a few days ahead of this flood that took place in Central Texas. It was not in the same area. Texas is a very big state, but obviously this has led to some questions of, wait a minute, this flood happens in the early hours of July 4th, and your last cloud seeding operation was July 2nd. So what's the deal? So the CEO of this company, Rainmaker, Augustus Dorico, is 25 years old. He's sort of a tech savant. You know, when you hear him interviewed, and I've listened to a few interviews with him, obviously an extremely bright person and really believes in this technology as a way to help, as a way to help communities and farmers and be something that's positive for society. Obviously, there's critique of it too. And now there's critique because of the timing with this flood. So I want you to hear, this is a longer soundbite, and I, depending on your questions, I might jump in and interrupt it, or I'm just going to let it play. But I want you to hear from him because he takes on what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what if they had any role in the flood that took place. He's appearing on Sean Ryan, which is a very, very popular podcast. And there's two interviews on this podcast with him. One was a couple weeks ago, just by chance. That is like his life story. But this particular podcast was just focused on, hey man, were you involved in this? Like, what should people know about it? So let me go ahead and play this soundbite for you.
I know you were there. I think it was 2 days prior to the flood, correct?
Correct.
And what were you doing there?
Sure. So just again, for those that haven't heard before about what cloud seeding is, in no uncertain terms, I run a cloud seeding company. We make a little bit more rain and snow for farms or for reservoirs or for aquifers when they're dealing with drought, right? Obviously, right now, after the flooding, Texas does not need more water, and we've indefinitely suspended operations because of that, and we'll keep them suspended until first responders have stopped working. Cloud seeding is not long streaks in the sky. It's not trying to dim out the sun. It's certainly not creating hurricanes. Cloud seeding is a technology that was invented in the U.S. that relies on clouds, natural clouds, with liquid water droplets in them, and flying into those clouds, dispersing material that then freezes onto those drops, makes big enough, heavy enough snowflakes such that they fall and either fall as snow or melt back into rain. We have customers throughout Texas, the South Texas Weather Modification Association, the West Texas Weather Modification Association. These are groups of counties and individual farms that pay us for cloud seeding because they historically have needed more water, right? If you look even back to June 24th, not long ago, a lot of Texas, a lot of the hill country was in severe or moderate drought, right? And so what we were doing there on July 2nd and prior was trying to make more rain for these farms and for these reservoirs and to recharge the aquifer because they tend to need more water. We were operating on the 2nd and we flew one 20-minute cloud seeding mission. So we seeded two clouds and we dispersed 70 grams of silver iodide into those clouds. First of all, those clouds dissipated over the course of the 2 hours after the mission, right? So did we seed the storm itself? No, absolutely not. Did we seed clouds that dumped tons of precipitation? No, not that either. Like the most successful cloud seeding missions that have ever been conducted either by Rainmaker or research labs have produced tens of millions of gallons of precipitation. They got hundreds of billions of gallons of precipitation over the course of just hours and trillions cumulatively. So cloud seeding, though it can make useful amounts of water for these farms and ecosystems, cannot produce a million times more than what the best operations ever have. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is, well, you know, maybe because you like seeded those two clouds on the 2nd, the material stayed in the atmosphere and then made the flooding worse later. And we know categorically that that's not true either. When you seed into clouds and there's subsequent precipitation, the material that you disperse gets precipitated out with the rain, right? So one, we know that by seeding into the clouds, the aerosol dissipated. But two, even if we had just been seeding into open air, and we weren't, right? It was 20 plus hours between when our mission occurred and when the flooding ensued, and the winds were blowing northwest such that any of our aerosols would have been long and far north had they even persisted in the atmosphere, and they didn't.
Now, hold on, let's rewind.
Yeah.
What were you saying about, what was that last thing?
About the aerosols up there. So one thing.
The wind.
Yeah. So the winds when we were seeding were blowing to the northwest, right? In the ensuing days, right, you had the storm just plop down and pound this one particular area. Mm-hmm. But when we were seeding, the winds were going northwest such that any of the aerosols that could have possibly remained in the atmosphere, and I don't think that any consequential amount did, they would have blown out of the direction of the storm as well.
You don't think or you know?
We know.
Did you see those clouds dissipate?
Yes.
Do you have that on video?
We have that on radar.
Here's a good follow-up by Sean. You think, do you know? Or are you just thinking? I found something. One of the questions that I haven't been able to, let me go ahead and pull this up for you, haven't been able to find out, and it would be a question that I would like to ask Augustus someday, is just how much all of this costs, you know? What is the cost to get to make something rain? You know, how much? I have no idea. I have zero idea. This is a graphic that I just saw on Forbes.com that I wanted to share with you. It shows what actually took place in Texas. So in some cloud seeding operations, they're using drones. In other places like Texas, they use small planes, so six-seater planes. And they're going over the top of the clouds. As you can see here, they drop the silver iodide into the cloud. And that is what's going to hopefully help the precipitation, hopefully help if that's actually your goal. And as you heard from Augustus there, hey, this was brief. It was limited. The wind was blowing in an opposite direction. It's not going to lead to more of this storm. And I will have to leave that there for the next voice that we can have that'll come in on this issue. Because the question is that correct? Is what he's assessing about his technology correct? Now, overwhelmingly, he's done a lot of press over this last week. It seems that there's more of a doubt about whether or not cloud seeding actually works, like whether or not it's an effective technology at all, let alone whether or not it can lead to an additional ingredient to a more powerful storm. And so I just leave that there. There's a lot to learn on this topic, and we don't necessarily have all of the information. We have what the CEO is saying here regarding this particular storm, and I haven't heard from Texas or elsewhere a strong critique of that. Again, more of a question about whether or not this technology is actually effective. Amy is bringing a really important point that actually Augustus talked about in his first conversation with Sean. Amy says, cloud seeding was a big thing in China. I lived there for 18 years. Remember the 2008 Olympics? Word on the street in Beijing was that there was a lot of cloud seeding to help. They discussed this, Amy, that they use cloud seeding, again, according to this interview, to get a clear sky. So they did some cloud seeding before, and then that actually led for the snow to happen, but then a clear sky. They were very actively doing weather modification in China, and that China actually has a department of thousands and thousands of people working on this. What's interesting about this particular CEO, he's young, he's new, he is excited about this technology. He's also asking for more federal oversight. So you know, most of the time, CEOs don't necessarily want oversight. He's like, hey, we need a plan. States can do this, but what are the federal rules to the road here? And how do we want to approach this as a government? And by the way, you have other governments investing hugely in this technology. What does that mean, not only for the weather that we're all experiencing, but also for national security? Because we know that cloud seeding has been used in the past by militaries. So there's a lot to think about there. I know I'm just brushing kind of on the surface of this topic, but I'm curious if you're interested in learning more about it, because if you are, then we'll do some more deeper dives. But as of right now, again, we don't have a strong voice saying that this actually led to harsher weather, which led to a more severe flood that I know of right now. We'll see what comes up. What seems to be coming up really about this story in Texas is a question about, and it's not even a question from the local press. It's a question that's being asked more on a national news level about federal involvement and whether or not the Trump administration is doing enough or doing the right things on the ground. Kristi Noem was on Meet the Press with Kristen Welker this weekend, and she was explaining a different philosophy, which is that, and not a different philosophy, the way that it works is that if you want federal involvement as a state, then it has to be requested. The federal government, out of respect for states, doesn't just come in and take over. And so she says the requests have been met. And really what we're seeing locally is that the response to Kerrville is overwhelming, even from volunteers. And so maybe some of that question of more effective response could be flushed out in the future. But right now, that seems to be, again, sort of a news headline that's happening from the national press, not necessarily something that's a conversation here on the ground, that something was botched. That's not definitely not a news story that's getting a whole lot of play. It is out there, so I want you to be aware of it. And there's always that question in a crisis about state versus local versus federal response. So I'll continue to keep an eye on that story to see if it develops further. Right now, it's tough to know, is the critique coming because there's actually a problem on the ground, or is a critique coming because more people want to be involved and they're not necessarily being involved? And what does that look like? So we kind of have to sift through that a little bit. We do have news coming from Washington, D.C., and we're going to change our topic here because we do have a news item coming from President Trump, who announced something brand new when it comes to the war with Ukraine. And he had a meeting with the NATO Secretary General, the head of NATO. Again, NATO, the largest military alliance in the world. You know, it's interesting to take in the stories that we've been covering for so long and think about it within the context of some of the stories that are maybe affecting more immediately Americans. So the flood in Texas is one of the deadliest events for Americans that we've seen in recent history. So we have that in mind. And then we're also thinking about international events as well. You know, how do we kind of take in these items and prioritize them? And how does that change depending on how the news develops? So it almost seems interesting here in previous shows, you know, I might have prioritized what the president said first because he's the president of the United States, but not in this show. I want to focus on what's going to really affect your family right away, which is maybe more severe weather.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind. and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Coming your direction. So just something to sort of observe there. The president has this meeting early in the morning on Monday. He televises a conversation that in front of the press, he's sitting in the Oval Office. He's with all his guys. You know, I say his guys, his cabinet. He also has his chief of staff, who, by the way, is a lady, Susie. And so you have his team, I should say, right? He has his team in the Oval Office with him, and you have the press sort of surrounding them. So this is a scene I just want you to envision here. And he announces something new when it comes to Ukraine. I want to play it, and then I'll explain why it's significant.
A deal today where we are going to be sending them weapons, and they're going to be paying for them. The United States will not be having any payment made. We are not buying it, but we will manufacture it, and they're going to be paying for it.
How did you tell Putin this is
happening? I speak to him a lot about getting this thing done. And I always hang up and say, well, that was a nice phone call. And then missiles are launched into Kiev or some other city. And I said, strange. And after that happens three or four times, you say, the talk doesn't mean anything. My conversations with him are always very pleasant. I say, isn't that a very lovely conversation? And then the missiles go off that night. I go home, I tell the First Lady, you know, I spoke with Vladimir today. We had a wonderful conversation. She said, oh, really? Another city was just hit. So it's like, look, he's, I don't want to say he's an assassin, but he's a tough guy. It's been proven over the years. He's fooled a lot of people. He fooled Bush. He fooled a lot of people. He fooled Clinton, Bush, Obama, Biden. He didn't fool me. But what I do say is that at a certain point, you know, ultimately talk doesn't talk. It's got to be action. It's got to be results.
Just want to point out, you know, President Trump is from New York. A tough guy has a different connotation in New York than other places in the country, usually referring to organized crime and the mafia. So he's like, he's not, I won't say he's an assassin, but he's a tough guy, you know, which is basically saying the same thing, just kind of going through some of the regional language, as you might refer to it. So President Trump is announcing that we're going to be sending these more advanced weapon systems and missile defense systems to Ukraine, but we're doing it in a way that's not direct to consumer, if you will. So we're going through NATO. NATO, they're going to be purchasing these items from the United States. We're not just giving them as part of foreign aid or a foreign aid package. And that's something that the Trump administration has been very serious about, even during the first administration of President Trump, of making sure that NATO countries are contributing what they should be to their defense budgets so that the United States is not the only one, in the way that the administration is describing it, on the hook for gear and aid and any sort of supplies if there's a conflict in Europe. So this is a change. This is something that is a different way of supplying Ukraine with weapons. And in some ways, it kind of provides a little diplomatic cover too, because the president can say to Vladimir Putin, listen, Vlad, I didn't give it to Ukraine. I'm giving it to NATO. We're part of the military alliance, you know? I don't know what they're going to do with it. Now, I mean, we clearly know what they're going to do with it. Listen to this, though, behind the scenes omission by the president. I hadn't heard this before. And I wonder how much play this is going to get. But I picked it for you because I thought this is a very interesting insight. You know, the president's only been in office, you know, what, 6 months, basically? And so listen to how he describes these talks with Vladimir Putin further. It was interesting to hear him talk about the First Lady. You can imagine that going home at the end of the day, like, hey, babe, I got a lot of progress on this. And she's like, hey, have you seen this? But a lot of wives can relate to that. All right. So listen for what he shares here.
I felt, I don't know about you, Mark, but I felt that we had a deal about four times. Mm-hmm. And here we are still talking about.
And he didn't send serious people to the negotiation. So I remember that you were able with Marco Rubio and with Steve Witkoff to get these talks going in Istanbul.
Yep.
I remember I was myself in Turkey for NATO business in May. And we really put pressure on the Ukrainians to send a senior team into Istanbul. And they did. But then the Russians came up with this historian explaining history of Russia since 1250.
We thought, and I thought, we should have had a deal done a long time ago. But it just keeps going on and on and on. And every night people are dying. A lot of people, a lot of Russian soldiers are dying, by the way. And a lot of Ukrainian soldiers, too. But a lot of Russian soldiers are dying.
100,000 Russian soldiers since 1st of January. Since January. 100,000 Russian soldiers dead since January. So if anybody in Moscow is listening to this, again, 100,000 dead Russians since January. This is what President Putin is doing at the moment.
So that was likely not for domestic consumption here. As Mark Rutte was saying, again, the Secretary General of NATO, 100,000 Russians have been killed since January. There is a question about how much the Russian population actually knows about deaths that are happening in Ukraine. And to be honest, the accuracy of the numbers on all sides is, I don't want to say anyone's best guess, but the United States has a version, Russia has a version, and all we can do is report what the numbers are and source them correctly. We can't, there's no way to how to validate that. But there's a question about whether or not the Russian population actually understands how many people are going to this conflict. And at one point, there was a question about Russian mothers. I think if you remember a conversation we had with David Satter, a journalist that used to work in Moscow for many, many years before he was banished, exiled from the country, an American journalist, say that, you know, it's the mothers that are losing their sons. They're knowing that this is happening, but whether or not it's enough to cause unrest in Russia is another question. So I thought that was an interesting injection from Mark to say 100,000. You know, if Moscow's listening, 100,000, it's a lot, it's a big number. But what we heard from the president there is four times they thought they had a deal. And in the past, if you think back on the last few months of news, there was pressure coming from the United States, and they admitted here that they were putting pressure on Ukraine. Send your best people. The Russians are ready. But no, Russia sent a historian to lecture people about the rise of the Russian culture, you know, which we actually have heard from Vladimir Putin as well. So you're getting some really real insight there. Hey, we thought this was going to come together. We thought we had a peace deal, ceasefire, four times. Didn't have any of it. Now we're back here. We have more aid essentially going to NATO. Oh, and by the way, we're going to put tariffs, and this is something that was also part of the conversation, more tariffs, secondary tariffs, which means on countries that do business with Russia, potentially on Russia, if something is not reached in the next 50 days, something being some sort of progress when it comes to peace. So a story to watch. We'll see what Vladimir Putin responds. I mean, this is where X is very valuable. I'm going to just check real quick if I see anything. Sometimes Russia likes to talk. They have a Telegraph channel that is more useful. I don't see anything here. I see a meeting between Russia and China, the foreign ministers in China. So at least nothing right now. So we'll wait and see if there's a response here and if it changes the dynamics at all. In the meantime, the war continues. The war is continuing between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. There's rising pressure, and we could see that for the last year, on Israel to stop operations in Gaza. There was a reference in this meeting that perhaps that there's some progress being made on that. We'll wait and see to see if we get any more details on it. So just a little bit of foreign policy news. One quick thing I just want to flag for you, just real briefly. I have been keeping an eye on what's going on with Iran, because Iran obviously is a main supplier of Hamas, terrorist group that operates in Gaza. Curious, in the aftermath of this major military exercise that targeted Iran by the United States and Iran and Israel, you know, what's happened? Interestingly enough, the Ayatollah, which is the supreme leader of Iran, of a theocracy, so he's a faith-based leader, but also the head of government in Iran. He has a variety of different X accounts. So he has an X account in French. He has an X account in Spanish. He has an X account in English. He has an X account in Farsi. So a lot of different languages. in the account that's more for a domestic audience, let me see, I'll go ahead and pull this up for you if I can. Sometimes it can be a little difficult, and I don't know if that's because of some of the X restrictions. Let me see if I can grab it for you, because it really is, I'm getting the French version, which doesn't have it. The Farsi version has quite a few graphic pictures of the United States of America. I can put it in the show notes for you guys. Again, there's several different of these accounts. Let me see. I think I have it. No. So there were some pretty, again, graphic images of the Ayatollah and how he was displaying America. Let me go ahead and share this with you real quick. It wasn't what I was expecting to, but I want you to see it because no one's talking about it. So this is what is online by the Ayatollah. Let me make myself a little smaller. Here is the Statue of Liberty with President Trump's face on it being bombed, presumably, obviously, by Iran. And I'm going to translate this post. And it says this: the Islamic Republic delivered a hard slap to America's face. It attacked one of its key bases in the region and caused damage. The fact that Iran has access to America's important centers in the region and can take action against them whenever it deems necessary is not a small event. It is a significant event and one that can be repeated. So this is, you know, again, it's going out. It's not going out on all the channels, but the images in the video coming from the Ayatollah is not a change of tone. I mean, that's really the big picture. It's not a change of tone. And that's something just, again, to be aware of, because that could be the next big news story. All right, speaking of news stories, and this is the final one we'll tackle today. It is a doozy, though, and it's one, again, that we can take a lot of different time to look through, and I believe it deserves that. So a name that you've likely heard over the last year plus is Jeffrey Epstein. And one of the big news items from last week, although it was because of the timing of it, didn't get as much attention. And the fact that it got as much attention as it did shows that it's going to continue to. The Department of Justice released an announcement regarding Jeffrey Epstein. So just kind of zooming way out, big picture, Jeffrey Epstein was being prosecuted under federal charges going back to 2019. According to the U.S. government, he commits suicide in prison. One of his associates, Ghislaine Maxwell, was charged, and she's serving time. This is all related to the same illicit behavior. I'm going to use very careful language in case you have children around, and then if we do a deeper dive, we'll use more specific language, but obviously abuse of minors. And that spans, you know, several different very dark charges. Let's just say it in that way. One of the promises of President Trump in the lead up to his candidacy for president and during his candidacy was exposing the deep state and this an impression that was given that the deep state or the U.S. government or those in power were hiding or suppressing information related to Jeffrey Epstein because Jeffrey Epstein moved in circles of powerful people. And so one of the popular schools of thought over the last several years is that Jeffrey Epstein's connections with powerful people was exposed in an investigation of him, and that the U.S. government is suppressing this information because it could be embarrassing to people in power, embarrassing or dangerous. Now, there's been also other schools of thought about Jeffrey Epstein and if he worked for a foreign government and if there was blackmail involved. I mean, we can untangle this as much as you want. I feel like there's no place to go for this particular topic because it has a lot of people that have very strong beliefs and they're in their corners. But then it's like, what actually happened here? You know, what is going on? And is this a quote mainstream story or is this a story for the fringes? And like, how does this all work? Well, I would say it's not a story for the fringes because you have the Department of Justice involved, even the President of the United States talking about it. And what the Department of Justice did, and in fact, I downloaded it. So let me see if I could also pull this up for you. It was in a PDF form. And it was the FBI memo that was released. So I can also put this in show notes if you'd like to read it. It's about a page and a half. One of the important things to know about Jeffrey Epstein is that he was convicted of very serious charges in the early 2000s, 2007. And there is a news hook to this today and why I'm speaking about this case today beyond just this background. But I want you to have this background because the news item today is related to it, although not directly. So this comes out, this document from the Justice Department. And what the Justice Department is saying is that there's no there there. We were going to release more information to the public, like we promised on this case, but there's no there there. I'm going to read from it. This systemic review revealed no incriminating client list. There was also no credible evidence found that Epstein blackmailed prominent individuals as part of his actions. We did not uncover evidence that could predicate an investigation against uncharged third parties. So we look through everything and we don't really think that there's anything more there for the public. We also think that we can confirm that it was a suicide that killed him. I know there's been questions about that. And not case closed, but essentially that's what they're saying here. This led to an uproar from those that were supporters of President Trump saying, wait a minute, you guys have been telling us for months, even when you're in office, that there's something here that's coming. And now you're telling us there's nothing. So what are we to believe? One part of this memo that is getting a little bit lost in this sort of political debate is the fact that the Justice Department says that there were more than 1,000 victims of this individual. More than 1,000. So the Justice Department says each of these individuals had their own unique trauma, and part of the reason of not releasing more information is to protect them. But that number is huge. That's something you don't see very often. Again, I feel like it's sort of getting lost in the press. So why am I talking to you about this today? Well, there is a reason for it. Ghislaine Maxwell, who was a friend, associate, girlfriend, she's been described in a lot of different ways of Jeffrey Epstein. The federal government believes she's an accomplice to his crimes. That's what she was charged on in federal court. She's now serving time. Her attorney said when this first court case started, her initial one with the federal government, hey, wait a minute, she cannot be prosecuted because Jeffrey Epstein did a deal back in 2007 when he was being prosecuted by the state of Florida that said that the federal government could not prosecute him on the investigation of that particular case, nor could prosecute any of his alleged co-conspirators, of which there are a few named. Ghislaine Maxwell was not one of them. But that was part of a plea deal that Jeffrey Epstein put together for admitting guilt for a series of crimes that led him even to have to register as a sex offender. So very, very serious, okay? And this deal was done, but back in 2007. What Ghislaine Maxwell's lawyers are saying is, well, she's basically a co-conspirator. That's what the government is alleging. And she should be protected under this umbrella of a plea deal going back to 2007. The judge in her case said, no, that does not stand. An appellate court said, no, that doesn't work. But she appealed to the Supreme Court. And today, which is, by the way, totally her prerogative to do and her lawyer's prerogative to do, they can do it. Today is the deadline for which the Justice Department is supposed to file a response with the Supreme Court about why they would presumably disagree with that and disagree with the fact that she's even appealing to the Supreme Court. We do not know if the Supreme Court would take up with this case, and we don't know if it would, you know, change the story at all, or something would be revealed here with the, you know, front of the Supreme Court that's not otherwise revealed. We have no timeline on that. But just to know that part of this case that involves Jeffrey Epstein could wind up before the Supreme Court is something, again, I don't think is getting a lot of press. It's one of his alleged co-conspirators by the federal government that's saying that she's protected by a plea deal for many, many years ago. And the timing of this is tricky for the Justice Department because essentially they're coming out and saying, well, there's not much more to go here. And so one of the arguments back to them by critics of the Justice Department is, well, if there's nothing there, then why is Ghislaine Maxwell in jail? Is she the only one for 1,000 victims? Is that what the Justice Department is saying? It's only Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. There's nobody else that was involved. That's the stance, essentially, that the Justice Department either on purpose or mistakenly is giving out. So this is all part of this. So today is the deadline. It doesn't mean that the Justice Department has to respond today. I mean, they could miss a deadline. I mean, I don't think they get like penalized for it, but it's maybe a reminder to all of us is like, get your assignments in early, because then you avoid what looks like conflict when, you know, you have this massive news story involving kind of this case, and then you have to respond to the Supreme Court, you know? So we'll see what happens. We'll see what the Justice Department submits, and we'll see if we get a hand on that. But again, I don't think a lot of people know that this case against Ghislaine Maxwell could actually wind up before the Supreme Court. And there is a chance. It's not necessarily likely, because these other courts were like, And remember, for something to go in front of the Supreme Court, it has to be a constitutional issue that her rights are being violated in some way. It can't just be a disagreement. It's really the Supreme Court is for, like, deciphering the Constitution and how it applies and whether or not it's been violated or disregarded in some way. So we'll see what happens there. Again, this is a case I'd like to do a little bit deeper dive on for you, because I think there's nowhere to go. You either have to go straight to maybe some voices that you know have a certain angle in their reporting, or you just have nowhere to go. And I do think this is an interesting, awful story, but one that continues to come up. So even with Jeffrey Epstein being arrested in 2019, I mean, it's been years. There's still a way that this comes up in the press. And so can we give to you the key facts of the cases, key things to know about it that could help organize it? And I think that's one of the voids that Smarter News can fill. All right, drastic topic shift, and then I'm going to let you go. But this was, I'm going to just finish on a lighter note, because I thought this was funny. And we've been dealing with a lot of really serious news. And I read this and I thought, you know what? I bet a lot of people can relate. How many of you have a car? I didn't have a car for many, many years. And now I live in Texas and I'm driving constantly. You know what else makes you drive? Children. They got places to go all the time. They have social lives that are more dynamic than your own. I'm in the car constantly. I looked at the car this morning. I'm like, how did I run out of gas already? It's because I'm driving around like a maniac. So this is not the point of this survey. So there was a survey, J.D. Power Initial Quality Study, and it was taking a look at, you know, what do people like in their cars? What's important? And especially with so much advanced technology, you know, I mean, the cars can drive themselves. They can park themselves. They can do all sorts of things. What actually bothers people the most? We're in this time of, you know, incredible. You get air conditioning, automatic windows. I mean, think back just a couple decades. None of that stuff was in your car. Right? You didn't even have seatbelts. Okay. Now I had a CD player in my car. All right. Now I'm really dating myself. All right. We listened to the radio. So what are people really upset about when it comes to their cars? What is their number? Like, what is their complaint? What is the thing that bothers them the most? It's the size of their cup holders and whether or not their car gets it right. You know, can the cup holder accommodate all the things, the Stanley cups, the Yeti cups, your coffee cups? There's French fries in this picture. And that if it doesn't have a good cup holder every single day, you reiterate that point of something that's dissatisfactory about your car. So how will the car makers address this? You know, they're worried about all sorts of things. Again, AI technology. But this is what people really care about. The cup holder. And let me tell you something. I relate to this. I could use a few more cup holders in my car. How many of you? Okay. This is going to be a good test if my husband actually listens to the podcast. And my husband and I get in the car together, you know, in my car, which is, he has a truck. So the truck, you know, you have the car, the console cup holders, and then you have the cup holders for the back seat that are kind of nearby. So you could steal those if there was in the back seat. My husband usually has a cup of coffee and like a water. And then I have a tumbler of some sort, you know, and in my car, I don't have that. So then when we come into the car and there's three drinks, maybe four, maybe he's like, babe, you need a cup of water. You've drinking too much coffee. He's on me for drinking too much iced tea. You know, I'm like, hey, pick your battles, buddy. All right. Just relax. So he's giving, but he's trying to take care of me. It's a loving husband. He's giving me a water bottle. Now we got four. We got four drinks. We don't have any place to put them. Also, we're probably in the car for 20 minutes. Like, are we worried about getting dehydrated? Like, what are we, what is it? Is it because we don't have a time to relax and like have a drink of water? Is something good about drinking water or drinking iced tea in the car? Like, what is it? So this is a real problem for me is what I'm saying to you. And I don't have any solutions. And so I'm, you know, you ever get those like different ads that are showing you like how you can stuff things in your car and then you have like a container. I don't know if I can, if that's, is that a smarter item that we need to, we need to develop? I feel like there could be a lot of strong opinions on this. And I see some of them about different cars that, okay, wait a minute. Barbara's saying my 2008 car is the best cup holder. See, back when the imported things were prioritized, Barbara, right? It was none of this like a whole park. I've never had a car park for me. Like you need to learn a parallel park. Does that make me old fashioned? What just happened here? Number and placement. Her name's Betty and I love her. Okay. And this is what I'm talking about. Natalia, I usually have water in the morning, a coffee, so I need two. Forget if anyone else is already there. Yes, exactly. Okay. Sherry says my Highlander had four up front just for me. That's a dream, right? Because sometimes you just, it's not about a beverage. You want something else. You got maybe like a lipstick. You got something else that you just want for a car, you know? I know. This is exactly what we all needed today. Tara, my 2017 Santa Fe is a silver bullet. It has four up front, four in the middle, and two in the third row. That is good. That is good. See? It's the small things in life. That's what we'll come back around to. It's the small things in life that make us happy. We don't need a lie. I was having this conversation with my son last night. I was like, material items are not going to bring you happiness. I was like, take it from your mom who wasn't sure she could pay rent and go grocery shopping and what she was going to buy, you know, whether or not she was going to have a job. And I said, and now I don't necessarily have those same worries. I have them in different ways, you know, different ways, but not exactly the same as like living in New York month to month in an apartment. And I was like, that was a really happy time. So more doesn't necessarily mean better, but more may be better for cup holders. So I'll leave you with that. I hope you are well hydrated and you have no marital conflict from cup holders. And if you have cup holder suggestions, then we would love to hear from you. But it's been great to spend a little time together. Hope you're ready for the Monday ahead. Thank you to those of you who are joining us live that are big supporters of Smarter News that are investing in this solution news. We so appreciate you. Check out your cheat sheet today in your inbox because it's going to have a lot of these good show notes and a couple extra things in it as well. And I just want to make sure that we stay in contact because that's something very exclusive to you. And it's part of your support for Smarter News along with a advertising free podcast link. So for those of you who are insiders, that's what one of the benefits. And if you're curious about that, you can just go to smarternews.com/scoop and it has all the information there for you. So I appreciate you guys. As Lola just said on our feed, stay safe out there. Thank you to all of you. And we'll see you back with more on smarternews.com. Have a great day, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye.